This is WBAA. I'm Sam Clement, and I'm joined by Joe Haber, who is a professor emeritus of political science at Purdue University and emeritus director of Purdue's Jewish Studies program. Joe, thank you very much for joining me.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Joe was instrumental in Judith Tidor Baumol Schwartz's book, Never Look Back, The Jewish Refugee Children in Great Britain, 1938 to 1945, which is published by Purdue University Press. The book examines the lives and struggles of Jewish children during World War II as they escaped from Hitler's Germany to Britain, which was called the Kinder Transport. Joe, you were one of those children. How old were you when you left home?
I was almost 10 years old, about 9 months and 9 years and about 9 months. And I was in the first kinder. I was actually on the first ship to go to Britain on that kinder transport. No, I think December the 2nd. What is called Kristallnacht, which is a misnaming, which is really the Germans call it the night of the pogrom. November the 10th, and I was kicked out of school the next day, and my parents lived in we were very poor, so, and I had no school to go to, and we couldn't relocate, so they found out about the kinder transport, and I was out in the first ship that went.
Can you talk about the experience leading up to you departing on the kinder transport? What were the conversations like with your family as to what may happen to you and your family?
Well, really very little, because, first of all, I suppose my parents tried to spare me some of the awful things that were going on. So I was in confusion. I didn't know what was going on. And they really didn't talk to me. As I recall, I have no memory of their talking to me about it. All I knew was my father went on a train with me to the Dutch border, where the Dutch people took me, then to the ship, and off I went. So I think for me it was in essence a very confusing and ultimately a very traumatic experience.
Did you get a sense when you were on the train that this could be the last time that you see your family?
No, not really. I was after only almost 10. I wasn't thinking along those lines. I was in communication with my parents until they were able to write to me still when I was in Germany, because war hadn't broken out, so they could write me letters. And then when the Jews in southern Germany were expelled, this was probably 1940, all Jews in southern Germany were expelled, and they were sent to a internment camp, not a concentration camp, not a extermination camp, an internment camp in Vichy, France. That was the Rum state that was created after Hitler had invaded, or the National Socialists had invaded, Germany had invaded France. And even from there, they were able to communicate with me through Red Cross. So I knew to a certain extent what was going on. And my father died in that camp, and my mother was able to write me a letter about it. But then when war broke out in 1941, that ended.
Being that young and not having the personal face-to-face communication with your family, having to do it through letters, I mean, was that a trying experience as just being gone and being away from your home?
Well, the thing was, I mean, literally a trauma, I think, because some things happened once we landed in England. Remember, this was a very quick operation. The kinder transport was organized from November 1938 to first ship left in December. So that wasn't a long time. So one of the things that this kinder transport illustrates is when there's a will, things can happen very quickly. There weren't many committees. I mean, there's a big story here about how this happened, but it was very quick. And the second thing is when these children, must have been several hundred, got to England, there was an enormous amount of confusion. And, for example, in my case, there wasn't enough room. We were located in a vacation spot in the summer on the sea there, and there wasn't enough room in the buildings where people would go, so we were put into what I call cabanas. And I was put into the cabana, and it turned out that I was the last one of all of these wooden shacks. It was the coldest winter in 100 years. It was enormously cold. And so when I woke up, the hot water bottle, which I had frozen into a block of ice, and it turns out, and I had to repress this memory, that when I got out and I got out of the cabana, it was empty. Everybody had gone, and I was so they had forgotten to take me in. So that sense of abandonment was there, and then the thing that happened is I caught an infection, and the people in charge of me, they then saw this. They sent me to a hospital in Lowestoft, where the nurse was very nice, but they couldn't speak German. I couldn't speak English. And while I was there, some kind of chicken pox or something broke out in the camp where the children were. So we had to put in a quarantine. So for, I don't know, for how long, I was isolated in this hospital. When I finally emerged from this, I was in complete shock. And in essence, I kind of shut down. And I don't have many memories of the next 2 and 2.5 years.
In the book, it outlines not only the terrible conditions in Germany, obviously, but there are also challenges for youth like yourself once you arrived in Britain. You mentioned the language barriers. There were also families that didn't even want to take kids in. What was the experience like once you actually arrived there and were trying to get acclimated to life in Britain?
Well, actually, we were treated well. I can't complain about the treatment. Remember, there were two ways in which these children were taken care of. One of the conditions was that by which the British government allowed these children to come was they should not be a burden on the state, obviously. And the second condition was that the parents or relatives couldn't come with them. And there were reasons for this. It might seem cruel, but there were reasons for that. And so once you got there, the question was, where are we going to house these children and take care of them? And one way was, of course, with the children. You took children were then sort of adopted, quasi-adopted by families. And the other one was you went into a hostel. A hostel was sort of a quasi-orphanage. Obviously, these children still had parents at that time. And I went to a hostel. And there was a kind of also... It turned out to be very kind of odd because there was a selection process. You know, cute little baby, you know, cute little kid, and obviously I wasn't chosen. I wasn't cute enough. But when you got into the book, I think deals mostly with when it talks about this with children who went in with families because I talked to her about this because I was interested. What she might have found out about children in hostels, because that was a different experience than going to families. When you went to a hostel, the issue became these hostels were then usually there were Jewish children, so you had to have the Jewish atmosphere or religious circumstance. And as the book I think sort of goes into this, there was a real issue about trying to maintain and keep the Jewish identity of these children. And this was a problem primarily for those children who went with families. It wasn't a problem for me because I went into a hostel that was Orthodox, in essence, or traditional at least, traditional to Orthodox. So that was fine, and we were treated reasonably well. But the one thing that... was, from my experience at least, was neglected, or at least wasn't dealt with very much, was what were the psychological impacts of these experiences on these children. Now, in America, if this sort of thing happens, you have battalions of trauma, nowadays at least, trauma experts coming around. We had none of that. You were sort of on your own. Now, this may have been just my experience, and in other hostels and in other circumstances or with families, some children may have gotten psychological counseling or help. I was on my own. I had to deal with, when I woke up finally, when I was about 12 and a half, I had serious psychological problems. I knew it. I had enough insight to understand that I had serious psychological problems, and I had to deal with them by my own, which was, you know, feeling of abandonment, feeling of worried about being rejected, that kind of stuff, dreams, you know, for many years. Depression problems, serious depression problems developed for the next probably 25, 30 years. Then I don't know, no longer have that. But so it was really a traumatic experience.
Ultimately, how did you get over those issues of abandonment and depression?
It was a long haul. It was a kind of a determination. Now, some of this depended on how people were always interested me about the reaction of young, you know, of people to trauma is what are the factors that condition how they respond. Well, obviously, one of them is a temperament. You know, there must have been something in me which said from the very beginning, I know I have a problem. I'm going to get over it, however long it takes. And I would read, for example, the GIs were coming through this hostel because this was a Jewish hostel. This was back in 1942, 43, when we were getting ready for D-Day. Large numbers of GIs were coming to Great Britain, and the Jewish ones, many of them would come to our Jewish functions like Passover and the Sabbath, and they would bring with them all these paperbacks. You know, the troops had to be entertained, make sure they don't get into too much trouble. So they had hundreds and hundreds of paperbacks, titles, and the GIs would bring those titles, and they were, you know, novels, poems, histories, and I became a voracious reader. And so that's one way that saved me, the reading. I was a very poor student. I was at the bottom of my class. It was a miracle I graduated from this vocational high school. But I was a voracious reader. And there was also the Andrew Carnegie public libraries that were all over the place. So I was in the library and the books and the ability to walk in the countryside and kind of talk myself out of the depression. And I would read also these we Americans, I can say that. I'm an American. We Americans are real suckers for self-help books. And I would read Dale Carnegie's How to Make Friends and Influence People. That was one of my Bibles. You know, 10 rules how to make friends, 10 ways of doing this. That helped a bit. And then I read a book, I think it was an American author, Smiles, I think. Life Begins at 40. So when I got very depressed, I would say, I don't care how long it takes me, even until I'm 40, I'm going to get out of this, you see. So it was a kind of upward, you know, the depressions lasted, and I had to fight them. And eventually, when I came to America, I had to get some psychological help. First one was a psychoanalyst. And, you know, so it was that determination. The second factor that sort of influences this is the kind of family constellation you're living in. Is it a warm, huggy, you know, in America, we were into hugging. In my family had a lot of, you know, they were very poor. My father was an ill man, so it was not, obviously, in difficult times. So my father was not, we were not into the, it was a kind of a, it was not a happy situation. It was not a happy environment, the family, you know, because of all the difficulties. The third one is the environment you live in. In this case, this was southern Germany, conservative. In my town, was conservative. And so that has something to do with it. Third or fourth, you're living in a larger culture, which is German. And fifth, you're, you know, and the other thing that is, of course, important in how one responds is what happened, you know, the experiences of your life, who you meet. And I met occasionally people in England and elsewhere that were very helpful and very supportive. And that this was true in England. This was true when I went to graduate school and elsewhere. So, you know, people that your life experiences, some of them are good, some of them are bad. And fifth factor is the fact that you don't know, you know. You can't measure these things and quantify them. There are things that... So the whole combination of these factors sort of help to, not to explain at least part of how I manage from this enormously shy, kind of traumatized kid into this self-confident Joseph Haber today? And how from the, you know, the student in England who was in the bottom of the class when all these other Jewish children were always at the top of the class, and to a professor, no less, at Purdue University. I mean, that's the miracle, I suppose.
You definitely closed the gap on that. Yeah. How often do you allow yourself to go back and think about that experience going on the Kinder Transport, World War II, that era? Given you said you shut down as a child for like 2.5 years and obviously the results of the psychological effects afterwards, but how often do you allow yourself to go back and think about those experiences?
Well, quite often, actually, nowadays, because I've never been shy about, if people ask me about it, I would talk about it. I've never been, at the same time, I've never been somebody, hey, you got to listen to my story. If you're interested, I'll tell you about it. And with my children, too, when they ask me questions, I would tell them. I wasn't trying to say, I don't want to talk about it, it was so painful, which is quite frequently the situation with some of the Kinder and their offspring. So this was not my problem. And I don't know why that was the case. Maybe you also guard yourself in some ways against, you know, the other psychological problems. What I think was important in my case is that I felt that the Kinder Transport was an important event because it illustrated, first of all, as I said earlier, how quickly things could be done when there was the will to do it. Number two, it also illustrated that that even under the, and this is also true of Holocaust survivors in general, that what always impressed me was the enormous capacity of human beings to recuperate or recover from awful experiences that you'd think they'd never recover from. And I saw some cases later on of the children who came to this hospital later on who came from the death camps. And what amazed me about those children was how they, given that they'd been in, really almost in hell and had seen awful, awful, awful things, yet all they wanted was to live in a calm, quiet environment. Most of these other children who came, this was sort of the third Kinder Transport. You know, after the Second World War, these children from the camps had to be rounded up because they were pretty wild. And then they had to be kind of calmed down. And about 15 or so came to this hostel that I was still at in 1940, probably 1940, late 45 or 46. And they told me the stories about two of them came from the Warsaw Ghetto and had survived the Warsaw Ghetto by escaping through the sewers. And so I understood and I knew a lot about the Holocaust at that point. And so the amazing thing about this, as I said just a moment ago, was that these children were really very, very nice, and they there was another story in there, but I won't, how, unfortunately, in the hostel where I was at, the person in charge didn't understand this and wanted to kind of force religious things on them, and they didn't really want that, and things got a little messy.
I want to go back to something you said earlier about you didn't have to change your identity. You didn't really lose your identity because of where you were, but how much of those kids that went on the Kinder Transport that went to families, as this is outlined in the book, lost their Jewish identity and lost kind of their family makeup religiously?
Well, that's hard to say. You know, you have a couple of plays on the Kinder Transport that deal with the issue of the impact of moving to another family. Let's say it's a Christian family who you identify with those new parents, really, and maybe in some cases there was pressure being put, you know, with the best of intentions perhaps, pressure put on them, these children, to become a Christian rather than Jewish. This is what she deals with quite a bit, I think. And I didn't have that problem, as I said. So I had the opposite experience because I was immersed for about 2.5 years or 3 years in the last hostel I was at, in a really in a modern but traditional Orthodox environment, which I liked in many ways. I still resonate with that traditional Jewish religious environment, even though I don't practice it today. So for me, that was, you know, it wasn't all bleak. It wasn't all horrible. And I had made friends, and I learned the language. I became, as I said, I don't think I learned English really until I was 13, because I think, as I said, I kind of shut down. But once I woke up, in that sense, there was no stopping me.
When did you eventually come to America?
I came to America in 1946. The issue was really, what is Joseph Haber going to do with his life? And when I went to my guardian, who was Mr. March, who was the head of this orphanage, and who had been the head of the Waisenhaus, the Jewish orphanage, Orthodox orphanage in Frankfurt am Main, which was the center of German Jewish Orthodoxy. And I said to him, I want to be a teacher, partly because I'd seen him at work and he wasn't doing too good a job. He was a good man, but he really had very little understanding of, I thought, of boys. And so I said, gee, I can do better than this. And I had read John Dewey. These GIs had brought over some stuff from John Dewey, the educational philosopher. And I read him, and I said, gee, that's the way to do it. I think I can do better. Anyway, I went to him, and I said, and he said to me, Joseph, you know, this was not malicious. You're not smart enough to be a teacher. So he apprenticed me to an accountant. This is the old Dickens world. You know, you sat on a high stool with a visor, and you edited that by hand. I became very proficient. And once a week, I would go out into the working class districts and slums of Northampton and collect rent. And that was a very enlightening experience. So, and then the question came, well, I don't want to be an accountant. I've nothing against accountants, but it wasn't my cup of tea. So I had a couple of choices. I could go to, I became an ardent Zionist, because we had a Jewish Zionist religious youth group, B'nai Akiba it was called, and I was very taken by the kibbutz movement, the communal movement over there, and I would have gone over there, but I knew psychologically it wasn't for me, because I had had enough with, you know, living amongst kids, and I had my own problems, and I wanted to be a teacher. So then I got a message from, I could have stayed in England, because by that time the British had changed their minds, and they had said, if you want to stay, you can stay, and which was not the original condition. And then I had an uncle and aunt in California who knew about me, who knew my situation, and they asked me, did I want to come over to America? And I said, yeah. And so that's how I ended up in Oakland, California, where I went eventually to, very quickly actually, to San Francisco State Teachers College. And those were marvelous days, because, and now you can eat your heart out here, because in those days in California, once you were accepted into the university or colleges, and you were a citizen of the state, you had to pay no tuition. It was tuition free. Nice. Aren't you eating your heart out?
I am. Joe, it's very early in the book by Judith Tidor, Baumel Schwartz, where she mentions you as an inspiration behind making this book come true. What is it about this story that you want people to know, and that why you thought it was important that this story be published?
Well, what impressed me about her book, the book actually emerged from a master's dissertation that she did back in 1981, when she must have been quite, you know, fairly young, probably in her mid-20s, I would guess. And I was stunned, I was impressed by the thoroughness of her research, the clearness and lucidity of her writing, and I'd come across other references, so I said, I asked the Purdue Library to get me a copy of the dissertation. I saw it and I said, hey, this thing really ought to be published. So I got in touch with Charles Watkinson, and he found her. Her name had changed. He found her, and he then, I guess, negotiated with. Now, the condition was that she rewrite and bring things up to date, and which she did, I think, very extremely well. So the book, it's based, you know, upon that dissertation in some extent. But she did some further research, interviewed some more people, kept the literature up to date, and it's worth mentioning also that this book is part of a series of the press called Shofar Special, Shofar Supplements in Jewish Studies, which means it's also written so that it can be used in classrooms or in churches or in adult education. It has study discussion questions at some point here. I think it's near the end of the book. It also has an extensive, probably the most extensive bibliography. So anybody who's doing any kind of work on the Kindertransport, and this is the kind of book that I guess a 17-year-old senior in high school could read and understand, right? I mean, it's not jargon. There's no jargon in it, as far as I can tell. And so the bibliography is extensive, so you don't have to go and hunt around for a bibliography, because most of it is there already, up to date. And she did all that additional work in 1 year. Again, she's an amazingly productive, able scholar.
As you read the book, what emotions, what memories came to light?
Well, I hadn't realized the extent to which there were conflicts within once we got to England, because there were all sorts of issues that came up, administrative issues, how do you take care of these children, that she discusses. And the one thing the book, I thought, didn't do enough of, it's not her doing, is there is very little discussion of the hostels. Now, I asked her about this. For example, I said, do we know how many hostels there were? You know, there were 10,000 children that came over, all ages, you know, from maybe 5 or 6 to 15. How many went to hostels? How many went to families? She said, well, those, she looked for them, couldn't find them. I tried to find my own records. I got in touch with the agency, and they gone. So there's a lot of historical material that is not available. So I think this book, another reason for this book, is that I think it is in some sense very likely the definitive story and history done in a very thorough, comprehensive, scholarly way, yet readable and accessible. So it's not just for the expert. That is in print and is likely to be that definitive for the future. I cannot, you know, there may be things you will be able to study of what happened before the Kindertransport, but for the war years, you know, what happened there, this is it, definitive, I think. And I think it really is important. The other reason that I haven't mentioned why this book is important and why the Kindertransport is important is because it has enormous relevance to today, because you have God knows how many refugee children, and we need to learn the lesson of the Kindertransport and try to not just look back, you know, Lot's wife looks back when the Bible turns into salt. We need not just to look back, we need to understand that we can learn from this and address the issues of refugee children today. That's what I'm always emphasizing. Whereas there is an impetus to kind of look back. It's important. I'm not negating that. But I think we ought to need to look at today and forward and see how this can inspire us, perhaps, or how we can learn from it. In any case, what I emphasize or tend to emphasize is learn from this, understand it. It has an intrinsic interest in this, like history. History is not just because it's useful or you can learn something from it. It's also very often intrinsically interesting. I think this story is intrinsically interesting. But we can learn a lot from it, of its relevance to today.
Joe Haber. He is a professor emeritus of political science at Purdue University and emeritus director of Purdue's Jewish Studies program. He was also one of the main sources of inspiration behind Judith Teitur Baumol Schwartz's book, Never Look Back, The Jewish Refugee Children in Great Britain, 1938 to 1945. Joe, thank you very much for joining me.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you for having me.
For WBAA News, I'm Sam Clement.